Johnson versus Noli. Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Attorney Eric Straub. I'm from the law firm of Kahelski, Etta & Straub, and I represent the petitioner in this case, Mr. Noli. I believe that there are two primary issues that are presented before the court today. The first issue this court has somewhat dealt with in the past in the case of State versus Dundon, and that would be if a statutory self-defense claim, particularly 939.45 sub 2, is applicable to the crime of carrying a concealed weapon in the state of Wisconsin. The second issue that has been primarily raised by the state in this case in response to the petitioner's brief is whether there was a sufficient offer of proof in this case if, in fact, the court does decide that that self-defense is applicable as a matter of privilege. Now, as I had indicated, this court has dealt with this issue in another context rather thoroughly, and that is the case of State versus Dundon. And in that case, the primary distinction with this case is that it was a common law claim of self-defense that was before the court, and this court ultimately rejected that claim, finding that it was not appropriate to extend the common law claim that was made in that case for self-defense to the circumstances that Mr. Dundon presented, which this court concluded were general and potential fear of and some type of attack. Now, I believe that the present case is clearly distinguishable from that on various grounds. The court probably remembers Mr. Dundon was a clerk in a gas station, and he had $22,000 that he needed to take to the bank, and the armored car hadn't come for several days. He decided prior to that to go retrieve a weapon because he had been a victim of crime before, and particularly robbery, in case he might be the victim of some type of attack in this case because of the money that was involved. I think that that case is distinguishable from this case and the facts very clearly in that it was an incident that happened in the daylight. This is an incident that happened at night. Mr. Dundon was primarily in his car. Mr. Noli was outside of his car changing a tire in this case. Mr. Dundon had no specific encounters with anyone who could have possibly been a threat to him during the time that he was possessing a weapon. Mr. Noli encountered four men on a street corner that were very in close proximity to him that were being loud and profane. Yes?
Just when you say encountered, as I understood, just factually, his car had a flat tire. He got out to change flat tire, and there were four people about 30 feet away. So there was no encounter as far as there was, as I read the facts, as far as the physical encounter I'm talking about.
I would agree with the court, Your Honor. There was no physical encounter in terms of actual touching, or there is no allegation that there was ever any approach of the two parties. By using the term encounter, I simply mean that Mr. Noli did have a flat tire. He did stop at the McDonald's to change the tire. And as he was changing the tire at some point, he notices these individuals on the corner. And based upon his observations, he feels that an encounter is imminent and that that encounter is something that he needs to use the privilege of self-defense in order to prevent unlawful interference with his person. Mr. Dundon, again, had the gun in that case for the entire time that he was in the car, whereas Mr. Noli was not armed. As the court is probably well aware from the facts, we have a situation where Mr. Noli is changing his tire. The gun and the ammunition are in two separate toolboxes. He takes those out. He arms the weapon and places it in his waistband, presumably within sight of the individuals that are about 30 feet away. Now, the Court of Appeals...
Mr. Straub, let me stop you at that point, if I might. As I understand the facts here, at the time the police officers arrive, they find your client sitting in his car, the gun in his waistband. There are not four loud and profane individuals around. Do you think that if the self-defense privilege applied here, it continues to apply the rest of the night? or do you think that it applies only to the point where the four individuals get on the bus and leave?
I think that it applies for a reasonable period of time. I think that the ultimate standard in this is Mr. Nolley's reasonable perception of the imminent unlawful interference.
Does the record show what the period of time was from the time the four individuals left until the police officers arrived and found your client sitting in his car, perhaps asleep? I know there's a dispute about that, but
there
perhaps
is a dispute.
Asleep.
There was a disputed trial. The facts were disputed. There is not a specific time. The best that I can give the court from the offer of proof is that I think both parties felt that it was a matter of moments between my client changing the tire after having put the gun in his waistband and being seated in the car, and then the officers arriving.
Now, I understand your client had a cell phone with him. Where was the cell phone when he was found by the officers?
Interestingly enough, actually, I believe he had two cell phones with him. I don't know if that's clear from the offer of proof. I have the benefit of being the attorney at trial. I believe that one of the cell phones was on the hood of the car, if I'm remembering correctly, and I believe that there was another cell phone that was in the interior of the car.
So there were two cell phones, one on the hood of the car and one in the interior.
That is correct, yes. And I know that the state has certainly made the point that Mr. Nolley could have availed himself of these cell phones in order to call the police as opposed to arming himself. My argument certainly would have been, well, first of all, I think that's a jury issue as to whether that was a reasonable course of action for him to take. I think that I certainly could have argued at the trial and would have, in response to that, that an armed robbery can happen in a matter of seconds, and that certainly the response time between calling on the cell phone, getting a hold of the police, and having the officers arrive at the scene, given his fear that he was going to be robbed, this clearly could have occurred in a matter of 30 seconds to a minute, and the perpetrators could have been gone. So I don't think that that necessarily, simply the presence of the cell phone itself, indicates that Mr. Nolley's belief was not reasonable. But again, I think that is primarily a jury issue, and the problem that we have in this case with what the trial court did was essentially preclude the defendant from really ever making that argument and allowing the jury to fulfill its function of determining whether, in fact, this was a reasonable belief. With that in mind, I will move somewhat to the issue of the offer of proof in this case, because it's primarily what the state disputes at this point. The state has somewhat conceded that the law of self-defense generally is applicable to CCW. They have now conceded, in light of the Court of Appeals opinion, that Dundon does not necessarily preclude self-defense under 93945 sub 2. They're now saying, and I think they're kind of trucking in the old arguments, quite frankly, in the guise of the new, that Mr. Nolley did not make a sufficient offer of proof. And I think that this court has been very clear since State versus Mendoza that it is a reasonable construction of evidence that will support the defendant's theory in viewed in most favorable light as it will admit from the standpoint of the accused. And I believe that a sufficient showing was made in this case from the standpoint of a light that was most favorable to Mr. Nolley. In particular, Mr. Nolley was in a high-crime neighborhood. He was stranded because he had a flat tire. It was late at night, past midnight. There were four men, and he was only one person. There's no testimony indicating that there was anybody else at that intersection at that time. These individuals were loud and profane. They had no real apparent reason to be out at that late hour on a weekday being loud and profane. They were within 30 feet of him. He was changing a tire, being in a very vulnerable position, trying to focus on what you're doing with the car, crouched over the tire, while you feel someone is threatening behind you, perhaps actually to your back as you're doing that. And I think significantly, Mr. Nolley was a victim of an armed robbery in strikingly similar circumstances in the very same neighborhood, just a few blocks away. And I realized that that was one of the issues in Dundon, and it's certainly one of the, probably the primary issue that these two cases have in common in terms of the facts. But I think it's very distinguishable, and I think it's an important point to make that that evidence is used in a very different way. It was offered for a very different purpose with Mr. Nolley. In Dundon, that was used to support a general fear of the neighborhood. And I agree with the court's decision in Dundon. I mean, essentially, if we allow that type of defense for a general and potential fear, then it essentially swallows up CCW and would render it meaningless. This is very different, where Mr. Nolley is saying that what he observed from those individuals on the street corner, based upon his past experience as a robbery victim, led him to believe that he was going to be a robbery victim again. So it's not evidence just to support the fact that there was crime in the neighborhood. It's evidence to support his reasonable belief that there was about to be an imminent and an unlawful interference.
Could I ask you a couple of questions? 27th and Capitol, high crime area, 1 after 1 o'clock in the morning. Is that enough when the man stops the car? Is that enough to have...
It's a high crime neighborhood.
Yeah.
I don't think so, and I think Dundon clearly speaks to that. And
didn't you say a minute ago that an armed robbery could happen just in seconds? And that he's vulnerable. He's looking away. He can't be looking around at all times here.
Well, I think that certainly... In order for self-defense to be proffered in this case, there had to certainly be more than just a general fear of the neighborhood. Because I think that at some point you open it up to the floodgates to a certain extent. And I think that extending it in this fashion is not going to do that, because there are going to only be some very specific circumstances where you can actually have the gun on you prior to doing this. I mean, Mr. Nolley had the gun in his trunk stored took it out and loaded it. Most people, I think, are going to be in situations where they're actually carrying the gun. And in fact, most of the case law in the states across the country, including the ones that the state has cited in their brief, are just those type of situations where a person, either because they fear the neighborhood or because there has been a threat several days earlier, they decide to arm themselves in their home or wherever they have the weapon, and then at that point they decide to go out into the public. And I think that's the primary way that this would be more restrictive, is most cases you're not going to have somebody that is in Mr. Nolley's situation where he can have lawful access to the gun and decides to take it out when he has this imminent fear and threat.
But here Mr. Nolley, and Justice Crooks and Justice Prosser addressed this about just the concept of the late at night in the high crime neighborhood, but in observing that's why I asked about the encounter of the four individuals or where they were. Now they had left, you said it was a momentary leaving, but he's sitting in his vehicle and still armed. Now that goes back to the danger wasn't there, except if you say it was a high crime neighborhood late at night. Doesn't that belie what you're... In other words, the main fear was that he had been in prior armed robbery, had been the victim, and or that he was concerned about these four individuals who had now had left.
I think the main fear was in the background of being in a high crime neighborhood, primarily he was concerned about these four individuals, and it was his belief, based upon all of those facts and circumstances, that those four individuals were about to rob him. And that was certainly heightened by the fact that it was 4-on-1. It was certainly heightened by the hour at night, etc.
What I was getting at is that they no longer were there.
By the time the officers had arrived, yes, but it's not clear, really, from either party when these individuals left, and I think that ultimately is a question to be addressed by the jury as to whether they believe that Mr. Nolley had a reasonable belief when the officers are testifying that these individuals weren't there when they arrived on the scene. And unfortunately, we never reached that point because the court kept it all out. I think that the question that the justice raises is one that is essentially a jury question in this case, and unfortunately, Mr. Nolley was not allowed to ultimately present that issue to the jury as to credibility of his version versus the officer's version.
It strikes me that when we have a felon in possession of a firearm, we recognize a test that excuses, gives a privilege. And one, I think, would be self-defense. Now we don't have a felon. We have an upstanding citizen. I'll use my facts, whether they fit your client or not. An upstanding citizen, not a felon, and has a gun in the car. Not loaded, properly stored, right? Now, should something go wrong, one would think this upstanding citizen, should have at least the same rights as the felon in terms of a firearm, right?
I would agree, Justice.
And if I understood you right, and the state will speak for itself, the state agrees that Dundon doesn't preclude a self-defense privilege under carrying a concealed weapon. So essentially they agree. So it seems to me the issue in this case is what is the preliminary standard? Well, you were here for the last argument, right? On self. Oh, okay. Well, that case raised the issue about self-defense, too. And that there would be a preliminary hearing before trial, on whether the defendant can present evidence of self-defense. So there had to be an offer of proof and some standard for showing self-defense. Okay? Sounds like your case. Okay. So what is the standard that you want the judge to use to determine whether or not the evidence could go in at trial?
I would simply state that the standard that is elicited in Mendoza, in terms of if the defendant is able to indicate in a light most favorable to him that he had a reason to believe an imminent and unlawful interference with his person, and makes at least some showing of evidence to support that at that point it becomes a jury issue. And I think Coleman is instructive in that case, this court was very critical of the trial court in a situation where the trial court was saying that a knock on the door was not sufficient to make Mr. Coleman believe that a robbery was in progress. And this court very clearly indicated, the court in that case infringed upon issues that were rightly the province of the jury. And I think in that respect, Coleman is very similar to this case in the type of arguments that the state is advancing to try to indicate that Mr. Nolley has not presented them a sufficient offer of proof.
And that's an objective standard.
Yes.
Could I ask you, would the four young men have been entitled to carry a firearm? I mean, they're out at night at 1:30 in the morning. It's according to the record, it's a high-crime area. They're vulnerable. If there had been three men, two men, one man?
Again, Justice, I think your decision in Dundon speaks directly to that. Under CCW, a general and potential fear based upon being in a high-crime neighborhood and generally being vulnerable, potentially being the victim of a future attack, and there are some cases that have been cited by the state to support that from other states, that is not sufficient to support a self-defense claim to CCW, to carry a concealed weapon. So I think that the four gentlemen in your case, if they had had weapons on them, they would have, by virtue of the fact that they're standing on the corner, they're already unlawfully possessing those weapons. And I think Dundon clearly indicates that based upon the crime in the neighborhood and their general vulnerability, that they would not. I think the difference between Mr. Nolly's case is that he sees specific people on the corner, and in response to that, he decides to arm himself, and that the weapon until that point was lawfully stored in his trunk, and that it is only in response to that specific threat that he takes it out. He's not decided that, you know, I've been an armed robbery victim before, and I'm driving through a very dangerous neighborhood. I think before I leave tonight, I'm going to, you know, pack my pistol and take it with me everywhere I go as long as I'm in that neighborhood. That's not the situation, which is why I think that this doesn't open the floodgates. There are only going to be a very rare number of cases. Emergency cases, I think, is the word that's commonly used in other jurisdictions than Wisconsin, where an individual can take a weapon that is lawfully possessed and use it in an unlawful way, but for the privilege of self-defense.
Well, suppose these four guys are walking down the street and they see your client, and they know that one of the ruses to get people to stop is car trouble, and then you rob them, right? So they go to their car and they get their gun, and now they're carrying a concealed weapon, and now they're up on charges. Would you defend them on the same grounds you're defending your client?
I think that it would be difficult under that circumstance to convince a judge, and even if that preliminary objective standard was passed, to convince a jury that four individuals would have been threatened by one person. Clearly, if the only way that Mr. Nolly, if the roles were reversed, would have been able to entice those people over to him, was to tell them that he needed help with his car, and then perhaps to pull a concealed weapon out on them and rob them. I think there are a lot of other avenues that were available or would have been available to those four people if that were the fact scenario. If you're afraid or you're fearful of that situation, you don't have to help Mr. Nolly. Go call the police for him. It was certainly a motorist kind of emergency situation, but it was not a life or death situation. Mr. Nolly, on the other hand, is not in the same situation. I mean, he is vulnerable, much more vulnerable than the four individuals, and this is a situation where he's got a flat tire. I mean, he doesn't have the option. He's got to change it, and because of what he perceives, he may not have enough time to call the police and have them respond if, in fact, these people are going to rob him. And I think it's important to note also that it is his reasonable belief. It's not what they were actually going to do. And it's Mr. Nolly's reasonable belief of that unlawful interference that ultimately is the question that should be presented to the jury.
Now, suppose there were police around and they saw these four people in the middle of the night walking around in a high-crime district. Could the police stop them and ask questions and do a pat-down search? I'm trying to get a standard that's somewhere else that we can adopt and bring in here. I mean, if that would be... Yeah, sure. If it's reasonable suspicion for the police under those circumstances, then is it reasonable suspicion for your client? I mean, that's what he's really doing, right? He's acting on what you say is reasonable suspicion, reason to believe.
The only problem that I would have with that is that I think Mendoza, in terms of presenting a defense, would dictate that the evidence that is presented would be viewed in a light most favorable to the defendant, whereas I think in a typical Terry stop, police would get that benefit.
That's right. We can just change that. That's not a big deal. Not a big deal to change to say that give the state the benefit. I might dispute with you as to whether the state gets the benefit there on a Terry stop. But if you gave the defendant the benefit, willing to use that test?
I think that that is a test that could be utilized, although I guess I think that the court has the tools in place somewhat now with Mendoza and the long history of case law in terms of what's sufficient to present a defense. And again, I hate to reiterate Coleman, but it seems like a very parallel situation. I understand that the court is making a parallel situation or comparison to a Terry stop and reasonable suspicion. I must confess, Your Honor, I hadn't thought of it in that way prior to the argument today.
Well, neither had I, counsel.
Counsel, let me take that question and just word it a bit differently. Maybe it's the same, but it is the same question. Earlier you were asked, what is the evidence that needs to be shown in order to establish this prima facie preliminary showing, threshold showing? And again, you cited Mendoza and said it's in the light most favorable. You have to make some showing. And that's what I'm asking you. What quantum of evidence constitutes that some showing? It's the same thing the Chief says.
I think that essentially if a defendant is able to present a factual basis that supports self-defense, I'm not going in the right direction.
Well, a factual basis beyond a reasonable doubt, a factual basis by clear and convincing evidence, a factual basis by the preponderance of evidence, a factual basis that's plausible, a factual basis that you have a reasonable suspicion of.
I guess that I would read Mendoza as putting in a standard of certainly not more than reasonable suspicion in a stop. In the sense that officers have a suspicion and that it can't simply be a mere hunch. In other words, Mr. Nolley has to have more than just a hunch that these individuals at the street corner are going to rob him. He's got to have other reasons based upon the facts and circumstances that support his belief that there's going to be an interference there. So,
well, that's bothering me, counsel. What did he have besides a hunch?
I think that he perceived that the individuals in the corner were going to rob him, and I think that sometimes that can be very subtle, but I believe that it is supported in this case. I think primarily it was based upon his past experience, but it was also based upon the other factors that were surrounding him in that point that made him feel vulnerable.
He's got past experience, so he's an experienced person. He's been robbed before. He's got nighttime. He's got high crime district. He's overwhelmed by just the numbers, right? Four against one. Correct. What else does he have? And does he need more?
I would argue that he doesn't. I think that ultimately you get into the jury's arena, but just to use as an example, a personal example, I was a victim of an armed robbery when I was in law school, and I was walking someone home, and I saw the individual that ultimately robbed me walking up the street, and he passed me. And as I turned to go back home, I saw that individual at the street corner. And it was my perception, because that individual was standing at the street corner, that something was not right, that that individual was going to attempt to do something. And I believed that even though there was a bus stop at that street corner, it was because of the eye contact, it was because of the circumstances that were surrounding that. It was late at night also. There were very few people on the street. I felt, even though this was a one-on-one confrontation, that certainly if the person had a weapon, that they could potentially overpower me and that I, you know, would be the victim of a robbery. I crossed the street and ultimately walked up the street and was satisfied personally once I passed that person on the other side of the street that the fear of unlawful interference was over. While I was wrong, that person, as soon as I turned my back, came across the street and came over and pulled out a gun and robbed me. So my suspicions, supported by the facts and circumstances that night, supported at least that I was going to potentially be robbed, and in fact I was. And I think that that's somewhat of what Mr. Nolley was going through in this case. Based upon his past experience, based upon the vulnerabilities of this particular situation, he feels like these people are going to attack him. And I think we can all relate to situations at night where we've encountered people on the street, and maybe we pull our keys up in a fist, or maybe we feel like that because of the actions of that person, even though not directed towards you, but they feel threatening. I believe I'm out of time.
In your most interesting account of your own experience, at what point would you have been entitled to have a concealed weapon yourself?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, I wouldn't have been entitled because I'm walking on the street, and in order for me to have the weapon, I would have had to put the weapon in my pocket concealed prior to walking that person home that night. However, if there is some conceivable situation where I was lawfully carrying that weapon, perhaps it was in a carrying case, and I was transporting it from one place to another, then I think that once I crossed the street, I would have been entitled to pull that gun out because I believed that this person was going to rob me. I think it's similar to the type of situation that Mr. Nolley was confronted with. Ultimately, these individuals, we don't know what they would have done, but at least one possible scenario is that they were going to rob him, and they decided not to because he took the gun out and stuck it in his waistband.
They'd have had to see that. Make that plausible. They would have had to see him have the gun.
Right. Unfortunately, we don't know where they are, and we don't know whether they did or not, but it's at least one plausible explanation that I think should be considered by the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Straub. Herman, Assistant Attorney General Herman, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman, representing the state of Wisconsin. The state's core contention in this appeal is that the privilege of self-defense was unavailable to Mr. Nolley under the facts of this case. Therefore, the trial court properly ruled that based on his offer of proof, no reasonable construction of the evidence supported a privilege of self-defense. And I think the key fact in this case that shows he was not entitled to a privilege of self-defense is that at the time the officers found Nolley sitting in his vehicle and discovered that he was carrying a concealed weapon, any perceived unlawful interference by the loud and profane men was no longer there. It had passed. He carried the concealed weapon beyond any possible justification. While his attorney's own offer of proof, the loud and profane men were gone by the time the police arrived on the scene. The only people Nolley claimed caused him to believe there was an actual or imminent unlawful interference with his person were these four loud and profane men at the bus stop who weren't there.
Well, counsel, if they had just left and they saw the police coming, did that change the situation? As far as we know, they momentarily part of the scene.
It's true that unfortunately in the record we don't have any kind of time frame on at what point these men left and at what point the police arrived. So that's a closer call if they saw the police coming and they ran away, but even so, at that point, he had the gun in a holster. He could have pulled it from outside the inside of his waistband and openly displayed it lawfully so that when the police arrived, he was no longer carrying it illegally in a concealed fashion. So he could have...
Could he have done that, really? I think we have a case that says that even a gun on the side of the passenger side is sufficient to amount to the offense of carrying a concealed weapon.
You are correct. When it's in a vehicle, if it's on the seat of the car, that's considered concealed, hidden from ordinary observation. I guess my point is that, I mean, it's a little, I'm a little skeptical of the facts of this case, saying that he was still justified because he's now in his car.
Is the car disabled?
It's according to the offer of proof and the testimony at trial, it was up on a jack.
So it's disabled. It's not like he could drive it away. So he's now trapped. Is he going to be trapped in the car? Or is he going to be trapped outside the car?
Well, I guess my point is that if, as Justice Wilcox was suggesting, a hypothetical situation maybe could have happened here, he fears an interference by these four men. These four men see the police car coming, these four men run away. He can get out of the car and say, you know, display his weapon openly to the police so that they, so he's not doing something illegal at the time.
Well, won't they shoot him?
Won't the police shoot him?
Yeah, there he is, waving a gun. I'm just showing it to you guys, just showing it to you. Or he could throw it out the window.
I agree that, you know, there's that risk perhaps, but I think he already had it in a holster. The holster was tucked inside his pants. If he simply untucked that, I mean, I'm not suggesting that he, you know, say, hey, I've got a gun. But there may have been something short of that he could have done to have openly displayed this weapon in a manner that would have been lawful.
Ms. Sherman, does the record reflect at all whether or not the police officers observed these four men at any point?
I believe that the record reflects that they did not see them at all. When they arrived on the scene, they were not anywhere nearby.
And I know there's some dispute, but what does the record show, to the best of your recollection, concerning whether or not Mr. Nolley was asleep?
Well, in his offer of proof, or in the offer of proof, or the discussion about what Nolley would like to present at trial, the state made the point that the officers would testify that when they came upon the scene, he was sound asleep and snoring in his vehicle. Mr. Nolley wanted to be able to claim, or his testimony would have been, had he testified at trial, that he had injured his back and that's why he was sitting in his vehicle when he was not sleeping. But the trial testimony from both of the officers was that when they arrived upon the scene, they weren't sure what was going on. They thought maybe he had, someone who was trying to strip the car. They didn't even see Nolley in the car. They didn't know what was going on. They weren't sure if it was a stolen vehicle or if someone had tried to strip parts off the car. They saw the car up on a jack, so they didn't even see Mr. Nolley. They approached the vehicle to try and figure out what's going on. They approached from either side of the vehicle, and then they see that Mr. Nolley is in the car. And their testimony at trial was that he was sound asleep. In fact, they flashed their flashlights in the vehicle to try and see if he had a weapon for their own protection. They were trying to figure out who this guy is. Is he injured? Is he still alive? They said that he was breathing but snoring loudly. And in fact, they testified that it took about 8 to 10 seconds. Well, first of all, they're approaching the car. Nolley's still asleep. They open the glove box. He's still asleep. They shine their flashlights in the car. He's still asleep. And it took prodding for 8 to 10 seconds, according to their testimony, to arouse him.
The car wasn't locked?
Apparently not, and apparently the windows were down, or at least some of the windows were down.
He's afraid, he has a gun, but he has an open car with open windows.
And at least according to the testimony at trial, and was sleeping at that point. And And that's really, I think, the crux of this case, is even if we could say he might have been justified earlier when those four men are being loud and profane at the bus stop, which the state does not concede even then that he's privileged, that he can act in self-defense to carry the concealed weapon. But even assuming that the privilege applied at that point, under no reasonable view of the facts could self-defense apply at the time the police officers arrive upon the scene. And I think that's a critical point, because if in this case this court were to find that he were justified at that point, it sort of suggests that once justified, always justified, or that the justification carries through well beyond any actual or imminent unlawful interference with the person.
Isn't this basically this case about whether we should judicially create a carry permit or a carry right?
I don't think it is, because that's not something this court can do. That would be for the legislature. There are, I don't know the number, but a vast number of states throughout the country that have concealed carry permits to allow people under certain circumstances to carry weapons in a concealed fashion, but our legislature has not seen fit to adopt such legislation.
Well, that's my whole point. I mean, if we allow this defense under these circumstances, isn't it tantamount to doing that judicially?
Exactly.
As opposed to leaving it to the legislature to say that you're driving around with a gun in your trunk, but if you enter a high-crime neighborhood and there's some undesirables around you, you've got a right to get your gun out and stick it in your waistband as you continue about your business
exactly.
in the neighborhood.
And that's not the role of this court, but also be undesirable, because if the people of this state and our legislature decides that it something that this state should adopt to have to allow people in certain circumstances to carry concealed weapons, there ought to be some serious thought that goes into what those circumstances are, rather than people taking it upon themselves to carry it whenever they want to. In most other states, it's limited. Well, in some states, as long as you get a permit and you're eligible for the permit and you get some safety training, you can get the permit. In other states, it's limited to certain categories of people based on their skills. So I think that's something that the legislature needs to sort out. Are we going to make it anyone, as long as they're not a felon, and they go through this safety training course and they get this permit, or do we want to make it more of a limited situation for people based on their type of job or other circumstances? So I think that is something uniquely left to the legislature.
And I'm now getting a little confused. Is it the state's position that there is no self-defense privilege under carrying a concealed weapon?
That is not the state's position.
The state's position is there is. So we're legislating on that? Is that your position? We're having a limited license to carry a gun?
I think what this court's job is, and what the self-defense statute is, and why we are saying self-defense is not unavailable as a matter of law, is that it depends on the facts of the individual case. Do these facts meet the existing statutory privilege of self-defense? If they do, fine, then you're privileged to carry a concealed weapon. If they don't, then you're not.
Okay. So we're doing a factual basis. Case by case, rather than a legislative basis.
Right.
So what are the facts? What is the standard? We asked counsel, you agree that there should be a preliminary offer of proof?
I did think about this, and I was here for the prior argument, and I'm not sure that I have all the answers either, but I would agree with counsel or Mr. Nolly that there needs to be some kind of showing, and I believe what the standard is, jotted it down here, whether a reasonable construction of evidence will support the defendant's theory of defense. So there's still, it's a reasonableness standard.
The theory of defense doesn't quite hack it. What is the theory of defense?
Well, basically, whether reasonable construction of the evidence will support self-defense as defined in the statute.
All right. And how much evidence?
I honestly don't have a good answer for that, I'm afraid. It's...
You don't want the judge to be the jury.
Exactly. We don't want the judge to... And it's not what it says is that the court's role, the trial court or reviewing court's role, is not to weigh the evidence. But I think what Mendoza is getting at when it talks about the court can't consider the totality of the evidence means if there are facts that are disputed, the court doesn't engage in weighing that evidence in determining whether the evidence should come in. Instead, what the standard means under Mendoza is that the court must accept the facts in the most favorable light it will reasonably admit from the standpoint of the accused. But this standard assumes that the versions are contradictory. Wait, let me see here. What that means is the court cannot accept one version of the facts and reject another if there are factual disputes. But what I think the standard also means is that if the facts are undisputed, that the court can consider all of those facts, all of the undisputed facts.
So here we have disputed facts, right?
On some issues, yes.
So the trial court's not going to consider the totality. It's not going to weigh the evidence. It's going to accept facts favorable to the accused and recognize, won't accept one version or the other. I don't know if this is all fits together, but that's what you said. So now you've got the defendant, who will look favorable on that, says four men, high crime rate, he's overpowered, middle of the night, right? And his experience is similar situation and he got robbed, right?
Right.
Yeah. So why isn't that good enough under Mendoza?
I think there are a couple of problems in this case. When we're talking about reasonableness, of course, we're talking about what a person of ordinary intelligence and prudence would have believed in the position of the defendant under the circumstances existing at the time of the offense.
Right.
And at the time of this act of carrying concealed weapon. And so, and I think that's the critical point here again, as I stated earlier.
Right.
At the time he's carrying a concealed weapon, when the police arrive, right. I think that's when we look at the facts. But also, I think it's important to note that a reasonable person is not a person identical to the defendant,
right,
in terms of his personal background and life experiences. So that would eviscerate any objective component of the reasonable person requirement. So in this case,
person, an objective standard is a person in similar circumstances as the defendant here.
But not necessarily someone with the exact life experiences, for example. Not necessarily someone who's been robbed before.
Understand it, it would be.
I'm not sure about that, but even assuming that to be true, even if we consider that this is a guy who's been robbed before, he's in this bad neighborhood, his car's broken down, and there are four loud and profane men at the bus stop 30 feet away. I still don't think that Nolly had a reasonable belief of an actual or imminent unlawful interference with his person.
Any
because,
time?
I'm sorry?
At any time?
I don't think at any time. I mean, I don't think there was any justification at any point for him to carry a concealed weapon.
So what, let's forget Nolly for a moment. Let's take somebody sitting out in this audience. They're sitting, they have a car problem on the corner of 28th and Capitol. And their car pulls off to the side and they see four people who are loud and boisterous and profane. And they've, at least the person who's driving the car, the student, subjectively believes that he's in big trouble. He's got a flat tire, and it's night, etc. What's he to do?
Well, in this case, what he's to do is take his weapon out and display it openly. If he really wants to if he really feels like...
And that's okay.
And that's okay. He had a holster. He could put it on his belt.
So the state is advocating that, the position that if you have a weapon, you just take it out. You know, you don't conceal it. You don't put it in your waistband. He's got to change a tire there. What does he do with a weapon?
Well, I'm certainly not advocating that people take out guns under the circumstances of this case, because
I heard you say, though, that he should take it out and show it. I mean, what's he supposed to do, take it out of the wallet and make a big showing that he's got a gun? And
No, let me step back. I may have misspoken or mischaracterized. What I'm trying to say is, under the facts of this case, I don't think he could ever do anything with his weapon. I think he had to stay in his car, because he at least couldn't carry it in a concealed fashion, because I don't think there was...
What would you do?
I guess there are a couple things I would consider doing. I guess if I pulled my car in, even though I have a flat tire, and I see people that look threatening, well, maybe I'll choose not to change my tire, and I'll go across the street to the gas station if it's open, and I'll just leave my car there and lock the doors. Or I'll use a payphone, or I'll use my cell phone, because apparently if I'm Mr. Nolly, I have two cell phones. But I don't think if I felt threatened, if I pulled my car into this McDonald's parking lot and I saw these people there when I pulled in, I might have chosen not to pull in there in the first place if there were another place nearby. And I understand the flat tire, you're not going to just be driving around the neighborhood looking for a good place to stop necessarily, but that may be an option when it sounds like, based on the facts of this case, there's a gas station sort of kitty corner from this McDonald's. Maybe that's a safer place to be, where there are other people around and a payphone if someone, unlike Mr. Nolly, didn't have a phone. But I also think in this case, there's no reason he has to stay there and change his tire. He can go someplace else and make the phone call to say, hey, I need a ride.
I have a separate question of a more, I think, threshold matter. Did Mr. Nolly ever threaten or intentionally use force against anybody?
That's part of my argument, too, as I made in my brief, that part of the privilege of self-defense. Self-defense justifies a threat of force or a use of force against another to prevent or terminate an unlawful interference. And here, I don't believe that there was a threat of force or a use of force by Mr. Nolly.
So why are we talking about self-defense as being available against a status crime like CCW at all? Because it involves no threat or use of force.
I've thought a lot about this question because I anticipated that the court would want to know how this could be possible. And I'll be honest with you, I'm hard-pressed to come up with a fact situation where I think someone could claim self-defense to carry a concealed weapon. I can't come up with a perfect one, but I don't think necessarily. It's hard to come up with a situation where, for that very reason, but...
I mean, people talk colloquially of, you know, keeping a gun or carrying a gun for purposes of self-defense, but the legal definition of self-defense is that a person is privileged to threaten or intentionally use force against another for the purpose of terminating or preventing an unlawful interference by another, etc.
Exactly.
So the situation has to involve, as a threshold matter, the use or threat of force as a part of the elements of the crime before the defense is triggered. That's a poor choice of words. Before the defense is available.
And I agree with that. It's difficult to imagine a fact scenario for certain crimes like self-defense, like carrying concealed weapon, where self-defense would be applicable, but I really think that the unavailability of self-defense privilege in a particular case
is based on the facts being insufficient to warrant the privilege, not that it's unavailable as a matter of law. And perhaps, maybe, if someone had a weapon concealed in their pocket, but the bulge was sort of in the shape of a weapon, and these four men at the bus stop see that I have this, maybe that could be a threat of force. I mean, maybe it doesn't have to be brandishing it, which, of course, the state is not encouraging that people be flipping guns around to show some force. Maybe that would be possible. Maybe if I've got a concealed weapon in my pocket and... I mean, I think it's possible.
I mean, the facts of the Coleman case, this all goes back to Coleman, right, which was a felon in possession of a firearm, and the court said that, you know, you might have a self-defense argument, but in Coleman, he pointed the gun, didn't he? He went and he got his gun, he felt threatened, and he pointed the gun. So that could, I suppose, be construed as
a threat. I think pointing would be a threat of force.
But if you're just talking about a carrying a concealed weapon where there is no use of the gun in any way to threaten or actually use force, I don't know why we're talking about self-defense as being available at all.
I agree to the extent that it's difficult to conceive of a fact situation that really fits it, but the state's not willing to go so far to say that it's unavailable as a matter of law, because I just think that we can't conceive of every possible situation, and I know of no law that says self-defense is not, I mean, a statute doesn't say self-defense is not applicable to these certain crimes. The carrying concealed weapons statute does not say self-defense is unavailable as a matter
of law. Right, but what I'm suggesting is that the two are irreconcilable conceptually.
On some level, I would agree.
Well, have you considered, have you looked at 93946, coercion? Would that have been available to this defendant? Because that does not require the actor to threaten or use the force. It just says a threat by a person which causes the actor reasonably to believe that his or her act is the only means of preventing imminent death or great bodily harm.
I think coercion could be available to carrying a concealed weapon. Again,
but it wasn't asserted in this case.
Well, and I don't think it would apply in this case because it has to be a threat. It would have to be a threat. Let me I want to just quickly read this coercion statute. I've got it right in front of me. A threat by a person. Okay, it's got to be a threat from another person to the actor, which causes the actor reasonably to believe his or her act is the only means. As I'm reading it, facially it looks like it might apply, but my understanding of coercion, and it may just be that I'm misreading it while I'm standing here, was I always thought it was someone saying, you better carry this concealed weapon or I'm going to do something else to you kind of situation. And that's always been my understanding of coercion, that there's someone coercing you to actually carry the concealed weapon.
Well, I bring it up
or something else is going to happen to you. So, I mean, I think it could apply. I'm just not certain that it applies here. I'm looking at the jury instruction.
Because it seems to me that the state's unwillingness to concede Justice Sykes' point seems to fly in the face of what the law says and what the statute says. And as I sat here thinking, I'm thinking, but, you know, the law must make some sense, and there must be times when a person can do this, what was done here, and then I looked at coercion. I don't know, I'll ask the defense attorney why he didn't raise that.
I'll try to answer your question if you want me to.
No, that's okay.
I think the best I can answer it, I thought I had the coercion.
I agree somewhat with Justice Sykes that perhaps the state concedes too much when it comes to the question of self-defense.
I'm looking at the jury instruction on coercion.
Typically, it involves a concrete or explicit threat by another, not just an inchoate
right.
threatening situation.
Right. Right. That was what my understanding was.
Could I ask an unrelated question? We had a case last term where that involved carrying a concealed weapon in an automobile. And there was a loaded pistol, and there were loaded rifle, uncased, or shotgun, and a rifle, and other weapons in the car. After conviction, the fine was $200. That was in a county just north of Milwaukee. Now, Milwaukee seems to have a very, very tough policy. Why is that, and what role does prosecutorial discretion play in this?
I think prosecutorial discretion does play a role in this. However, I think you've touched on the point of Milwaukee, and it is my understanding that Milwaukee takes a pretty hard line on any weapons offenses. They're going to charge him just sort of as a matter of practice. They don't want to have to try and figure out weed these out, but I'm not sure if that's still true. I think that at least that was my understanding when I argued the Dundon case here a couple years ago. I can't really speak to what their policies are now specifically, but I think you make an important point that we still rely on prosecutorial discretion, that there may be circumstances where it just seems like this person's actions have to be justified in some way, that maybe, like an example would be perhaps for a felon in possession charge, for example. I think there's a case out there somewhere where the defendant who was prior felon, has prior felony conviction, sees a gun on the floor, but there's a baby crawling towards it, and so he picks up the gun, and even though now that might fit under our Coleman privilege, perhaps, but at the time I don't think it did, and I don't think this is a Wisconsin case, but something like that, where it seems like the sort of a choice of evils kind of situation, which unfortunately our statutes on privilege, usually it comes in the form of a necessity privilege. Our necessity privilege in Wisconsin is quite limited to natural forces. But I think prosecutorial discretion can and should and does in most places play an important role in this situation. For an example of a carrying concealed weapons situation where maybe prosecutorial discretion could come into play is I'm walking down the street, I see a scuffle between two people, I see a gun fall to the ground, I pick up the gun, I know I don't have any way to lawfully carry it openly, but I don't want to be stopped by walking down State Street with this gun just in my hand. I tuck it in my pocket momentarily until I can go find a police officer to hand over the weapon. Maybe that would be a situation where a prosecutor might think, well, this person seems somewhat justified in some capacity.
Counsel.
But suppose he doesn't and you're arrested and charged. Do you have a privilege?
That's the way the law stands now, and perhaps the legislature should take a look at it and carve out some circumstances. As I think I said earlier, in response to, I think, Justice Sykes' question, there are other states that within their carrying concealed weapons statute, they carve out very specific and limited privileges that, maybe our legislature wants to take a look at that.
Justice Bradley has a question.
Thank you, Chief. In response to some of the questions, you said you've emphasized the facts of this case. There's no showing of threat or use of force, so how can it be self-defense? The guy was sleeping. How can you show self-defense? You started out saying that there's no reasonable construction of the evidence that indicates he's entitled to self-defense. Under no reasonable view of the facts, self-defense justified in this case. Does that mean that if there was any reasonable view that it should go to the jury?
I would think so.
And is any reasonable view, now I need your help, is there any reasonable view that
tantamount to saying it's plausible? You're asking me, can reasonable view mean?
No, you've said there's no reasonable view of the evidence, no reasonable view of the evidence in this case. And I have inverted that to understand you to say, well, if there was a reasonable view of the evidence, then the defense could go, you know, to the jury. There could be self-defense would probably be an issue in this case. Is that the standard, is if there's any reasonable view of the evidence? And then I'm pushing you to say, is there any reasonable view of the evidence? Is that tantamount to saying if it's plausible?
I'm not sure I've thought enough about that question to give you a definitive answer that binds the state for all future cases, but I guess I would just kind of go back to the reasonable person standard, what a person of ordinary intelligence and prudence would have believed in the position of the defendant. And I guess if the defendant makes an offer of proof and a reasonable jury under the ordinary intelligence and prudence standard could believe that that evidence would demonstrate self-defense, that then the evidence should come in. But I'm not sure about plausibility so much.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herman. Mr. Straub?
Thank you. Counsel has made, and justices have asked, several questions regarding the whole issue of whether Mr. Nolley was sleeping in the vehicle and how that impacts on this case. And I think that the answer actually is fairly simple. Those are all arguments that the state could avail itself of at a jury trial. It could certainly convince a jury that it was not reasonable under those circumstances for Mr. Nolley to believe that he had a specific and imminent threat because of those. But unfortunately, those issues were in dispute at the trial, and I think that's clear from the offer of proof, and that ultimately those are jury issues and should not impact upon the court's decision.
Was it your position that a person who carries a concealed weapon is threatening the use of force against another?
In this circumstance, I do believe that the issue that Justice Sykes brings up regarding the absence of any threat or use of force is not a problem. I believe that simply in the way that Mr. Nolley carried out this this arming of himself would have been in and of itself a threat to the individuals that were just 30 feet away from him. Now, I recognize that it is not clear from the record, and it probably ultimately would never have been clear at trial whether those individuals actually saw that display of physically taking the gun out of the toolbox, taking the ammunition out of another toolbox, loading the gun, and placing it in the waistband. I do, however, think that that sends a definite message. If someone is looking, and presumably if you have an imminent fear of unlawful interference, they probably are looking at you, that does send a message of threat. So I don't see that as the barrier in this case to self-defense. I think that there was a threat by Mr. Nolley, albeit a subtle threat, but a very clear threat. And I think, unfortunately, the state has somewhat gotten itself on the horns of the dilemma by making what I refer to as the Clint Eastwood argument that Justice Babich referred to a little bit, which is, you know, do you have to stand up and brandish it in the air and threaten in a very escalated way in this situation in order to avail yourself of self-defense? And I think that's a real problem because, number one, from a public policy standpoint, and the state's conceded it here, they don't want to encourage that. But number two, the standard under self-defense contemplates only the amount of force or threat of force that is reasonably necessary to terminate the unlawful interference. And I think Mr. Nolley was doing what you should do in a classic self-defense situation. If, in fact, once he has put the gun in his waistband and these individuals have seen it, they decide to still come forward to him, maybe at that point he pulls the gun out of his waistband and escalates the situation given the particular facts and circumstances he's confronted with. But to overcompensate and go the other way, clearly I think would prevent him from asserting a self-defense claim because it would be an unreasonable show of force.
Did you consider coercion, 93946?
You know, I considered every privilege defense that was available to Mr. Nolley, and really it was my opinion that the facts in this case only supported a self-defense claim under sub 2. I have the same interpretation of coercion as Justice Sykes has referred to. I think that it has to be an explicit threat, and I did not think, based upon the facts in this case, that was available to Mr. Nolley. I do think that there is not this threat problem with sub 2. That's what I can represent to the court, that it was considered and we felt like it didn't apply to him, and that this was the best course of action, especially in light of the court's decision in Dundon. In terms of some of the speculation as to what Mr. Nolley could have done, that he could have gone to the gas station, that he could have walked across the street or called on the cell phone, again, I think those are all arguments that the state can make to the jury. And I'm not saying that they wouldn't be able to make those, and I would have, in fact, expected them to make those at trial. But it's a credibility determination, and I certainly think that based on the facts in this case, it was not the case where Mr. Nolley, as the state has somewhat implied, saw these individuals prior to being in the situation where he was changing the tire. I think the offer of proof shows that while changing the tire, he notices these individuals in the street corner and he notices that they are loud and profane. And it was our position that he's already in the bad situation and really at that point doesn't have the option because of the disability in his car. I don't think it was clear also from the offer of proof. I think, in fact, in terms of the description of that intersection, Judge White's description of there being a gas station and a fish fry place was about all we have other than the McDonald's and the street corner where the individuals were standing. It would be my position that neither one of those places probably would have been open at that hour, and so Mr. Nolley probably wouldn't have been able to avail himself of those options. Unfortunately, the record does not say definitively one way or the other whether we do, and again, I think that's something that certainly the state could have rebutted with evidence to show that he did have those options and that was a jury question. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our hearing on 00-0744-CR State versus Nolley.